The best old-time radio from people you trust. The Radio Nostalgia Network, where the oldies are still young.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance, as dark locks in.
Man sighs in marble.
Laura and I were in Dymchurch on our honeymoon, when one day we walked out to Brenzett to see the church, and 2 fields from the church we found this pretty cottage, covered in roses and jasmine. A long, low building with rooms sticking out in unexpected places. It was apparently the remains of a much bigger house that had once stood there. After a brief examination, we took it. It was absurdly cheap. The rest of our honeymoon we spent in grubbing about in second-hand shops, picking up bits of old oak and Chippendale chairs for our furnishing. After a run up to town and a visit to Liberty's, the low, oak-beamed rooms began to be home. From the lattice windows you could see the marsh pastures, and beyond them the blue, thin line of the sea. We were as happy as the summer was glorious, and soon settled down into work. I used to paint in those days, and Laura used to write, and we felt sure we could keep the pot at least simmering. One October evening, I'd been down to smoke a pipe with the doctor, our only neighbour, a pleasant young Irishman by the name of Kelly. Laura had stayed at home to finish writing a comic sketch for a monthly magazine. I came in to find her sitting glumly at the kitchen table. "Mrs. Dorman has just called round," she said. "She says she's leaving us." Mrs. Dorman was the woman we had hired as our daily help. I frowned. "Leaving us? Did she say why?" Laura shook her head. "But she said she's going on Thursday."
"Only 3 days' notice," I exclaimed. "That's totally unreasonable."
Laura sighed. "If I have to cook the dinner, and you have to carry cans of water about, and clean the boots and knives, we shall never have any time for work, or earn any money, or anything."
"I'll speak to Mrs. Dorman tomorrow," I said. "I'm sure I can come to terms with her. It'll be all right. Now, why don't we take a walk up to the church?"
The church was a large and lonely one, and it looked at its best on that night, for the shadows of the yew trees fell through the windows upon the floor of the nave and touched the pillars with tattered shade. On each side of the altar lay a grey marble figure of a knight in full plate armour, with hands held up in everlasting prayer. Their names were lost, but the local story was that they had been fierce and wicked men, marauders by land and sea, who had been the scourge of their time and had been guilty of deeds so foul that the house they had lived in, the big house that had stood on the site of our cottage, had been stricken by lightning and the vengeance of heaven. But for all that, the gold of their heirs had bought them a place in the church. Looking at the bad, hard faces reproduced in the marble, this story was easily believed. The following morning I spoke to Mrs. Dorman. I told her of our dismay that she was thinking of leaving us, and inquired if perhaps her wages weren't high enough.
"No, sir," she replied. "I gets quite enough. It's just that my niece is ill."
"But your niece has been ill ever since we came."
"I might be able to come back next week."
"But why must you go this week?" I persisted. "Come, out with it."
Mrs. Dorman drew the little shawl which she always wore tightly across her bosom, as though she were cold. Then she said with a sort of effort,
"Well, sir,"
she sank her voice,
"you may have seen in the church, beside the altar, 2 shapes.
"You mean the effigies of the knights in armour?" I said cheerfully.
"I mean them 2 bodies, drawed out man-size in marble," she returned,
and I had to admit that her description was 1,000 times more graphic than mine, to say nothing of a certain weird force and uncanniness about the phrase "drawed out man-size in marble."
"They do say, as on All Saints' Eve, them 2 bodies sits up on their slabs and gets off of them, and then walks down the aisle in their marble."
"Another good phrase, Mrs. Dorman."
"And as the church clock strikes 11, they walks out of the church door and over the graves, and if it's a wet night, there's the marks of their feet in the morning."
"And where do they go?" I asked, rather fascinated.
"They comes back here to their home, sir. And I'm sorry to inconvenience you and your lady, but I must go on Thursday, Friday being All Saints' Eve."
I did not tell Laura the legend of the shapes that walked in their marble,
because I feared that a legend concerning our house might perhaps trouble her. Thursday passed off pretty well. Laura showed marked ability in the matter of steak and potatoes, and I confess that my knives and the plates, which I insisted upon washing, were better done than I had dared to expect. On Friday, Laura and I got up early. The housework was soon done, and we dined on cold steak and coffee. The walk we had that afternoon was, I think, the happiest time of all my life. When we had watched the deep scarlet clouds slowly pale into leaden grey against a pale green sky, and saw the white mists curl up along the hedgerows and the distant marsh, we came back to the house silently, hand in hand. Suddenly she said, "Jack, do you ever have presentiments of evil?" "No," I said, smiling. "And I shouldn't believe in them if I had."
"I do," she went on. "The night my father died, I knew it, though he was right away in the north of Scotland."
I did not answer in words. She sat looking at the fire for some time in silence, gently stroking my hand. At last she sprang up, came behind me, and drawing my head back, kissed me.
"Come now," she said, "light the candles, and we'll have some of these new Rubinstein duets."
And we spent a happy hour or two at the piano. At about 10:30, I got up to go out for my goodnight pipe. Suddenly, Laura flung her arms round my neck and held me as if she would never let me go again. I stroked her hair. Eventually, she loosened her clasp a little and drew a deep breath.
"Don't stay out too long," she whispered.
"I won't, my dear." I strolled out of the front door, leaving it unlatched. What a night it was. There was a strange grey light over all the earth. The fields had that shadowy bloom over them which only comes from the marriage of dew and moonshine, or frost and starlight. Across the meadows I heard a bell beat from the church. Looking in at our low window, I saw Laura half lying on her chair in front of the fire. The night still held me, and I determined to go up to the church. I felt vaguely that it would be good to carry my love and thankfulness to that sanctuary, whither so many loads of sorrow and gladness had been borne. I reached the churchyard and passed through the corpse gate between the graves to the low porch. I paused for a moment on the stone seat where Laura and I had watched the fading landscape. Then I noticed that the door of the church was open, and I blamed myself for having left it unlatched the other night. I went in. It will seem strange, perhaps, that I should have gone halfway up the aisle before I remembered, with a sudden chill, followed by as sudden a rush of self-contempt, that this was the very day and hour when, according to tradition, the shapes, drawn out man-size in marble, began to walk. Having thus remembered the legend, and remembered it with a shiver, of which I was ashamed, I could not do otherwise than walk up towards the altar, just to look at the figures. To assure myself, first, that I did not believe the legend, and secondly, that it was not true. I was rather glad that I had come. I thought now I could tell Mrs. Dorman how vain her fancies were, and how peacefully the marble figures slept on through the ghastly hour. In the grey dim light, the eastern end of the church looked larger than usual, and the arches above the two tombs looked larger too. And then the moon came out and showed me the reason. I stopped short. My heart gave a leap that nearly choked me, and then sank sickeningly. The bodies, drawn out man-size, were gone, and their marble slabs lay wide and bare in the vague moonlight that slanted through the east window. Were they really gone, or was I mad? Clenching my nerves, I stooped and passed my hand over the smooth slabs, and felt their flat, unbroken surface. Horror seized me. I tore back along the aisle and out through the porch, biting my lips as I ran to keep myself from shrieking aloud. I leaped the churchyard wall and took the straight cut across the fields, led by the light from our windows. Just as I got over the first stile, a dark figure seemed to spring out of the ground. Mad still with that certainty of misfortune, I made for the thing that stood in my path, shouting, "Get out of the way, can't you?" But my push met with a more vigorous resistance than I had expected. My arms were caught just above the elbow and held as in a vice, and Kelly, my Irish doctor friend, actually shook me. "Would ye?" he cried. "Would ye, then?" "Let me go," I gasped.
The marble figures in the church. They've gone. He broke into a ringing laugh. You've been smoking too much and listening to old wives' tales. I tell you, I've seen the bare slabs. Have you now? Well, I tell you what. I'll walk back to the church with you and you can show me these bare slabs.
You go, if you like, I said, a little less frantic for his laughter. I'm going home to my wife.
Ah, rubbish, man, said he. Do you think I'll permit of that? Are you to go saying all your life you've seen solid marble endowed with vitality, and me to go all my life saying you were a coward?
The night air, a human voice, and I think also the physical contact with this 6 feet of solid common sense, brought me back a little to my ordinary self, and the word coward was a mental shower bath. Come on, then, I said sullenly. Perhaps you're right. Back in the church, all was still as death. The place smelt very damp and earthy. We walked up the aisle. I'm not ashamed to confess that I shut my eyes. I knew the figures would not be there. I heard Kelly strike a match.
Ah, here they are, you see, right enough. You've been dreaming or drinking, asking your pardon for the imputation.
I opened my eyes. By the light of Kelly's match I saw two shapes lying in their marble on their slabs. He was leaning over and looking at the right-hand figure, whose stony face was the most villainous and deadly in expression.
By Jove, he said, something has been afoot here. This hand is broken.
And so it was. I was certain that it had been perfect the last time Laura and I had been there. I was keen to get home, lest Laura should fret about my lateness. I invited Kelly back to take a drop of whiskey with me. We saw, as we walked up the garden path, that bright light streamed out of the front door, and presently saw that the parlour door was open too. It was all ablaze with candles, not only the wax ones, but at least a dozen guttering, glaring tallow dips stuck in vases and ornaments in unlikely places. Light, I knew, was Laura's remedy for nervousness. We glanced round the room. The window was open and the draught set all the candles flaring one way. Her chair was empty, and her handkerchief and book lay on the floor. I turned to the window. There in the recess, I saw her. She had fallen back across a table in the window, and her body lay half on it and half on the window seat, and her head hung down over the table, the brown hair loosened and fallen to the carpet. Her lips were drawn back, and her eyes wide, wide open. They saw nothing now. What had they seen last? I sprang to her, caught her in my arms, and cried, "It's all right, Laura, I've got you safe." She fell into my arms in a heap. I clasped her and kissed her and called her by all her pet names. But I think I knew all the time that she was dead. Her hands were tightly clenched. In one of them she held something fast. When I was quite sure that she was dead and that nothing mattered at all anymore, I let Kelly open her hand to see what she held. It was a grey marble finger.
Man Sighs in Marble by E. Nesbitt, abridged by Roy Apps, was read by Harry Haddon Patton and produced by Celia DeWolf. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4 Extra.